is 80 degrees. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in the question of the week, we have a diatribe on lavender. Many people just refer to the different types of lavender as French, English, and Spanish, and that can be wrong and confusing. We'll give you a little lesson in lavender and help you provide the things that it needs to grow its best. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I have a question about my silver maple tree.
Silver maple tree. Okay, where is Sarah's silver maple tree?
I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
That's a great town.
Yeah, I like it.
So what can we do for you and your silver maple?
So the silver maple tree is planted in my backyard right by my fence, in the border between my yard and my neighbor's yard. And it's pretty big, and when I moved in, there were a bunch of dead limbs on it, and it was dropping of those dead limbs into my neighbor's yard. And then I had it trimmed up, so hopefully it would stop doing that. And then a couple weeks ago, it dropped a healthy limb into my new
really?
Neighbor's yard.
Huh.
And my neighbor was very upset about it because it crushed one of his little crepe myrtles. He really wants me to just chop the tree down. And I don't really like cutting trees down, first of all, but then it's also my only shade tree.
Right.
But I also know that a silver maple is just sort of notoriously bad for dropping limbs, and I'm just trying to decide what I should do, if I should chop the tree down to preserve my neighborly relations, or if I should just trim it up again and hope for the best, what do you think?
I will tell you that legally, your neighbor is allowed to do anything to any part of the tree that is on his side. So
okay.
Should he choose to hire an arborist to come out and, like, totally de-limb one side of the tree, he would have that right. Now, he can't force you to pay for it, but your rights to branches end at his property line. So
okay.
He is totally legally allowed to take every limb off on his side. How tall is the tree, though?
Maybe 40 feet high.
Yeah. How much did it cost you to get the work done the first time?
$700.
Yeah. This is an expensive proposition to remove a tree of that height. Many thousands of dollars. Have you gotten an estimate?
I've gotten a couple estimates, and they range. I got one today from a guy who said he would do it for $900. But before that, I had heard 2,000.
2,000 sounds a lot more realistic to me, because depending on the proximity of homes and the access to the tree, these are typically jobs that are done with cranes.
They can't get a truck into my backyard, and I think they'd have to take down my fence, and it would be this big thing.
Right. This $900 guy is offering to go up and do it limb by limb in the canopy and slowly bring it down, right?
I think so. No.
I would make sure he is a certified arborist. I would make sure he's insured and bonded. So it's probably time for a serious conversation with your neighbor. The two options are you can tell the neighbor what I've told you, that he has the right to deal with the tree on his side as he sees fit. He can take off everything that's hanging on his side. If this is an option that you like, maybe the two of you split the cost of limbing the tree overhanging his property. Now we've gotten the money down to being reasonable. It should satisfy him. And again, with proper care, with a really good arborist doing this at the right time of year, which would be in the dormant period in the middle of winter, there's a good chance that your part of the tree would survive, but with the caveat that, you know, it's probably dropping branches on your side too, right?
Yeah, it looks like some huge storm took off like about half the tree. So it's very lopsided.
Ah, gotcha. So then I'm going to suggest that the two of you sit down, have a real conversation, and maybe at the end say, you agree that this tree should probably come down. Can you split the cost?
Okay. If we do decide to take the tree down, do you have a suggestion for a good shade tree that I could plant?
See, that's going to depend on how much room you got in the ground. Those roots, that stump, you know, that's the thing. I will warn you that the slowest growing shade trees are the ones that live the longest and don't develop these kinds of problems.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Richard. How are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine.
And where does Richard do just fine?
Traverse City, Michigan.
Always a pleasure to hear from our friends up there. What can we do for you, sir?
I have a problem with some kind of a beetle that infests my roses.
Right.
They're the little short, light green-colored ones. They're voracious. They come back every year. I've been trying to pick them off, spray them off, but I just can't get ahead of them, and they just destroy the blossoms.
Yes, Japanese beetles and the other scarab beetles are notorious pests of roses. It is one of their favorite plants. Are they on your plants already?
Oh, yes. They've been there for a couple weeks.
Okay. Do you feed your roses?
No.
Okay.
No.
And are they mulched with anything?
No.
Huh.
This particular rose is what I call an old-fashioned rose.
Mm-hmm.
They grow wonderful. They're really a deep, rich smell to them.
Wow, that's
pretty.
Yeah.
But the beetles.
Yes. First of all, I'm very happy because typically the people with the worst Japanese beetle problems are feeding their roses chemical fertilizers, which attracts the beetles. So I'm glad you're not doing that. But the fact that these are very fragrant roses puts you at a disadvantage. The beetles can smell those roses, I believe, a mile away. So this season, I think you need to spray the plants like right now with an organic insecticide to stop this.
Okay.
And the two insecticides I would recommend, you should be able to find a spray whose active ingredient is either neem, N-E-E-M, or one of the spinosads, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. You would spray them on the plant, and then only insects who then chew that plant will be harmed by it.
Okay.
These are very dedicated organic insecticides, and with these beetles already in their feeding frenzy, there's not much else you can do.
Okay.
Now, do you have a lawn?
Yes.
I bet these beetles are breeding in your lawn. Make sure you never cut that lawn below 3 inches from now on.
Okay.
Do not overwater it. Female beetles will only lay their eggs in wet turf. If you let your lawn dry out between waterings, it makes it much less attractive, as does the high cut. And don't dare feed your lawn between now and the fall, because that'll weaken it. This will limit the number of grubs that'll be pupating in your lawn. But if you want to try to reduce the total numbers you're dealing with, this fall, sometime for you in August, you would spread a natural substance called milky spore on the lawn. You'll find this at any big garden center, and it'll come with directions on how to use it. You apply it to your lawn as directed, you water it in, and then any grubs that are feeding in your lawn will be killed by this naturally occurring disease that only affects scarab beetles. And your lawn will never again be useful as a breeding ground for the female beetle's eggs. Now, next year, here's what we're going to do. We're going to break this cycle. You've seen the Japanese beetle traps, right?
I haven't paid any attention to them, but I suppose I can find them.
I want you to get a single Japanese beetle trap next spring, set it up right next to your roses, and check it every day. When you get the first beetle in it, take it down. Don't leave it up, because then it'll start to attract more beetles. Now your job is to protect your roses for 2 weeks because during the emergence time, all the Japanese beetles will come out, and once they start to feed on a plant, they'll send out a pheromone that attracts other beetles to the site. So you need to prevent them feeding on your roses. I would suggest you cut any roses that are open or actively budded. And then the easiest thing to do is cover the plant with a sheer curtain for 2 weeks. Physically protect them from getting on the plant. During this time, they'll establish feeding sites at other spots in the neighborhood. After the 2 weeks is up, you can take that cover off and they will not come back.
Well, that would be great.
So you monitor, you cover, and then you're free for the rest of the summer. Because if those pheromones aren't deposited on your plants early in the season, it will not be a feeding station later on.
Okay. I can do all that.
You got a plan.
Got a plan. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Richard.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and sing loud the praises of the great Jerry Goldstein, a true hero of the organic and recycling movements who passed away earlier this month at the ripe old age of 91. Jerry helped popularize the wacky idea of growing your provisions without poisons as editor of Organic Gardening and Farming magazine in the Nifty Fifties, and then went on to create some of the most influential publications in the field of composting and recycling. But don't go lauding his legacy at biocycle.net just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and what lavender needs from you to bloom in that pretty shade of blue. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee offers seeds and live plants, edibles, flowers and perennials, treasured heirlooms, and high-performing hybrids. More information online at burpee.com.
It's 11:18. This is WHYY, 81 degrees and sunny skies in Center City.
Supporting WHYY, Burpee, hosting their June Garden Open through 5 p.m. today at Ford Hook Farm, featuring demonstrations, tours, and thousands of plants. Details at burpee.com/events.
Hey, WHYY members, find out how to double or even triple your gift to WHYY at no cost to you. Visit whyy.org/matching.
Food waste disposers grind up your food scraps and send them through the sewer system to Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plants, where they're converted into renewable energy and fertilizer. More information at philadelphiastreets.com. InSinkErator supports WHYY.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. WHYY's fiscal year ends on June 30th. The last 12 months have seen the first anniversary of our Newsworks Tonight program and the 25th anniversaries of Radio Times and Fresh Air. Now is the time to lay the groundwork for the next fiscal year and beyond. I hope that you'll consider making an end of fiscal year donation to WHYY before June 30th at whyy.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, lavender. I am guilty of the crime of telling people in cool climates that they may only grow English lavender. And I talk about Spanish and French lavenders for people in warmer areas. Well, it turns out those concepts are very misleading, and you should go by the botanical names, which I'm going to try to stumble through when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a fabulous phone call show at 1-888-346-9499. Hope, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very good, Hope. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And where is Hope doing great?
I'm calling from St. Augustine, Florida, but my question is about a location in Maryland on the Eastern Shore.
Oh, okay. What, I know the Eastern Shore very well. I actually love the Eastern Shore. Where are we talking about?
Yeah, I grew up there. I grew up in Cambridge. I'm getting married just outside of there in a town called Hooper's Island.
Oh, okay. And when are you getting married?
June 1st, next year.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you.
And what can we do for you?
Well, we went to look at the property, my maid of honor and I, and we had gone shortly after it rained, and it was about a week before, you know, the year mark, so around the same time that it will be next year.
Mm-hmm.
And we were attacked by swarms of biting flies, which I had forgotten about because I don't live there anymore. And I know that the mosquitoes are going to be a problem, too. There's a pond right there in the back of the property where we will be getting married. And I'm trying to find out, because obviously I don't want my guests to run away screaming. So I need to figure out a way to maybe deter them from where we are going to be, or anything that I can do to prevent them from breeding, I guess, while we're there. I'll have full access to the property 2 days prior to the ceremony. So I didn't know if you had any suggestions.
Oh, yeah. My first suggestion is, how could you forget growing up on the Eastern Shore getting bit to death?
The mosquito is the state bird. That's what we used to say.
Eastern Shore mosquitoes beat up birds. They take their lunch money.
Yeah. There's something else. That's
okay.
For sure.
So there's two aspects here. One of which, you're going to need access to the property before 2 days before, but you're just going to be there for like 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, I can do that.
And that's what we want to do is, actually, I would even do it beginning this year, is once a month I would throw the recommended number of mosquito dunks into that pond. Now, the active ingredient in mosquito dunks is BTI. It's a naturally occurring soil organism, and it prevents the breeding of any biting fly that breeds in waters. That includes mosquitoes, black fly, and those nasty biting midges, those gnats.
Okay.
So you get a lot for your money. The BTI treatment needs to be done once a month. You don't need to do it over the winter, but you can buy the dunks or briquettes online. They're totally natural. They won't mess with the fish or frogs or anything like that, but they will knock your numbers down considerably.
Okay.
And then 2 days is kind of tight, but what I want you to do is have in hand a concentrated garlic oil product.
Oh, okay.
These are available under many brand names. The original is known as Mosquito Barrier or Garlic Barrier. These are high concentrations of garlic oil that you spray on an area where you're going to have an outdoor event.
Okay.
Once it dries, after a few hours, you don't smell the garlic anymore. But it keeps biting flies, mosquitoes, and all those other insects out of the area for up to 6 weeks.
Oh, okay, wow.
So I would prefer to do this a week in advance if I were you, and then maybe a touch-up on the two-day thing. But again, there's no harm to you or your guests. And the combination of those two things, I mean, let's face it, honey, on the Eastern Shore, we're never not going to hear a slap, you know.
Oh, no, absolutely, absolutely.
But I think this would knock your numbers down astronomically. I think you would knock down over 90% to 95%.
Oh, that sounds great.
Of the problem. These garlic oils, these concentrated garlic oils, have been used to protect public places like outdoor concerts and things like that. And they have been remarkably effective. If you want to go for the gold, you can also buy or rent a machine called a mosquito magnet.
Yeah, I looked at those. I didn't really know what they were. They look like they're attached to like a propane tank.
Exactly.
Or something.
The big ones, the ones that cover a full acre, don't require any electricity. They run off a gas grill sized bottle of propane. And you would have this running for, like, I would start it up, like, 2-3 weeks a month before the event, and use that as kind of another way to clear mosquitoes out of the area. I think the dunks in the pond are going to be a huge help. I think the garlic oil is going to be your best bet. I think that's really going to protect your guests during the event. And if you wanted a little extra insurance, you know, mosquito magnet, put it on your registry.
My registry, that would be hilarious. Yeah.
You might be the only bride who has registered 55 gallons of garlic oil and a mosquito magnet machine.
Thank you so much. This will help me tremendously.
Well, thank you, and congratulations, and best of luck in your married life.
Thank you so much. I'll keep listening.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well, Bob. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
And where is Bob great?
I'm in Arden, Delaware.
What can we do for Bob in the great state of Delaware?
Well, I'm trying to make my backyard look like it's supposed to. It's supposed to be grass, and mine is about 30% grass, and the rest is something else.
Right.
It's got dandelions in it. It's got plantain. It's got round ivy. And my problem is we have dogs, we have a pond, and we have chickens, and my wife doesn't want anything on it that kills any of those.
Yeah, well, that sure sounds like a good idea, Bob. Let's not kill the dog and the chickens. I think that makes a lot of sense.
So the commercially available stuff that I see is dangerous to at least one of them. I was hoping you had a suggestion.
Well, when you have that much weeds and that little grass, the rule is that there's nothing you can do directly attacking the weeds, whether you're talking conventional deadly herbicides or the organic variables. They're for spot weeding, which means you've got like 10, maybe 20% of your lawn in weeds. But once it crosses the 50% barrier, you really need to resuscitate that lawn, probably plant a new one. Now, I'll just ask you the question just for the sake of argument, since you do have this water feature, you got these chickens out there, you got these dogs running around, what would be the big deal about just cutting what you have at 3 inches and enjoying the fact that it's mostly green out there?
Well, we've done that years in the past, and I had hoped that there was a better solution, because as summer goes on, the leaves, particularly the plantain, get big. And it's obvious that it's not grass. It's green, but it's obvious that it's not grass.
Right. Most of the problem in northern lawns is they're cool season grasses that suffer over the summer. But most of the weeds thrive in warm weather. So, yes, by the end of summer, most lawns are suffering their worst weed invasion. So, sun or shade?
It is probably about between 4 and 5 hours of sun as it moves around the yard.
Okay, so it's a fairly shady yard, which is probably working against you. Are there any big trees growing in and around the lawn?
There's an apple and a pear tree in the middle of the yard.
They actually tend to coexist a lot better than shade trees. I hope you keep them pruned to a reasonable size.
Well, I would say no to that.
Okay. So here's what I'm going to suggest. For this summer, I don't think you want to do anything. You would spend a fortune for very little return to attack the weeds directly when they're in this kind of a number. What I want you to do is circle August 15th on your calendar. That's when I want you to have somebody come, or you go out and rent a tiller or a tractor and literally rip up everything you have. And then, you know, rake away as much of the old green material as you can, but don't get nuts. Have a big load of yard waste compost or aged mushroom soil delivered. Spread it over the whole backyard. Level it out well. That will serve you well in the future. Leveling the lawn will allow you to give it a much cleaner cut in the future. And then I want you to sow a turf-type tall fescue. That is a great grass for your region. It's very rugged. It will establish beautifully at the end of August, beginning of September, and it will tolerate shade. Now, because you have dogs running around, you'll have to overseed the bare areas that they create every couple of falls. But that's perfectly normal with fescues. That's just how they grow. And you would only do the sowing of the new lawn and the filling in of the seed in the fall. And then after that, make sure your lawnmower always has a sharp blade. Never cut it below 3 inches. If you're going to feed it, only feed it in the spring and fall, never in the summer. and you should have a lawn that will have the fewest number of weeds possible going forward from there, and at a lot less expense and trouble. You'd be literally wasting your money on any herbicide at this time, because we're also getting into the time of year where your wanted grass is just going to struggle to survive no matter what. The fact that you have chickens, you realize you'll have to keep them off the lawn until the seed sprouts.
Until the seed sprouts, right?
Right,
so they don't eat the seed.
Because they would eat the seed. But the nice thing when you're sowing the seed in at the end of August, beginning of September, it's up and growing within 5 to 7 days. So it's a very short period of time.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds like a plan.
It is a plan, and that's how I want you to think of it, to be ready with the tiller and the tractor, to have picked out the seed, to have the compost source ready. Because if you can install this between August 15th and September 15th, I guarantee you'll have a fabulous-looking lawn for years to come.
Okay.
All right, man?
Very good.
Good luck.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Nancy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Nancy. How are you?
I'm doing really well, thank you. How are you?
I am excellent, thank you. Where are you?
I'm calling from Flemington, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. That was famous for some factory outlet when I was growing up, right?
Yes, yes. It still is there. What is it called? Oh, wow. Embarrassing. I can't remember what
well,
my son works there.
Oh my! Then you're worse off than I am. You know. All right, Nance. What can we do for you in Flemington, New Jersey?
I'm calling regarding crepe myrtles. I have two, one in the front yard, one in the backyard. The one in the backyard gets direct sunlight from about 11 to 4, and is growing probably about 8 or 10 feet tall. Has lots of blooms on it.
Good, good.
And the one in the front only gets morning and late afternoon sun, the way the sun comes across the buildings. And that one's maybe about 3 feet, 4 feet tall.
Does it have any flowers?
It does. They both get lots of flowers.
Okay.
And I guess my question is, when do I prune? Do I prune the dead blooms right after, or do I wait until the spring? The late fall.
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. Now, were these two a match set, or is it possible they're very different varieties and maybe even species of crepe myrtle?
No, they're the same. The what happened with the one in the front was always smaller, but then when we had that really bad snowstorm 2 years ago, I live in like a townhouse, so all the snow from both sides of the driveway went on top of it.
Oh, okay. It's been naturally kept in check.
Pretty much, yeah. I actually thought it had died, but it seems to come back, and now it's more bush-like rather than tree-like.
Well, they can look either way, which is why I asked if maybe it wasn't a different variety, because some crepe myrtles are naturally tree-like. Some crepe myrtles are pruned into a single tree-like form, and some are naturally shrubby. So, you know, there are dwarf crepe myrtles. There are standards that grow, you know, 20, 30 feet tall. But your timing is perfect. I will tell you, and I will remind all our listeners, you never prune anything in the fall. All the plants are trying to go dormant, and the last thing you want to do is prune them as they're trying to go into their winter dormancy. You can just sap all the strength from the root system in the crown of the plant. So you always want to allow the plant to go dormant. And then the best time to prune crepe myrtles is in the spring, right as they resume growing for the year. That is the perfect time, and the perfect pruning amount is typically the amount that the tree grew the previous year. So the one in the back, how many years have these guys been in the ground?
The one in the back's been there about 4 years. They've both been there for 4 or 5 years.
That sounds right, yeah.
Time.
So this thing is probably putting on a good 2 feet of growth a year now that it's nicely established. So
yeah,
that would be the ideal situation, is every spring you would cut it back to where it was before it grew the previous year. That's the best way to keep the flowers at the correct height. And do you like the height of the tree in the back?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So that's all you would do. Now your job in the spring, when everything starts greening up, is just prune it back to get rid of the previous year's growth. This will not only keep it at the height you want, it will absolutely guaranteed give you a better flowering display than an unpruned crepe myrtle.
What kind of fertilizer?
I don't think they should need anything other than a naturally, you know, a little mulch of compost. Keep wood mulch away from them. Don't give them plant spikes or chemical fertilizer.
Nope, I haven't been doing that, and so they've been doing really well.
Yeah, trees typically, once they get established, they don't need to be fed. They know where to find their own food.
Yeah, the first year I wrapped them up so that they were, you know, protected, because that's what they said, if it gets a lot of wind or, you know, it's an exceptionally cold winter, to wrap them so that they're protected. But then I haven't done that.
No, I don't think
they've been doing well.
I don't think you'll need to. Global warming has extended their range much further north than it used to be.
I snowplow, so last year I didn't get much work.
All right, Nance, you take good care of your myrtles.
All right. Thank you. Enjoy your day.
Thank you. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll reveal how to get your lawn off drugs on Sunday, June 24th at the Earth Fair in Burlington County, New Jersey. The American Horticultural Society's 20th Annual Children and Youth Garden Symposium will be held at the University of Maryland's College Park campus July 19th through the 21st. And the 15th Annual Woody Plant Conference will be held Wednesday, July 25th at Villanova University. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow lovely lavender. I'm lovely Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Lovely Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee has been providing gardeners with seeds, plants, and supplies for growing everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs for over a century. More information online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies offers professional master's degrees that teach students the critical skills for emerging professions in the natural and social sciences. Degrees in environmental sciences, medical physics, applied positive psychology, applied geosciences, and the liberal arts draw on Penn's research specialties. Part-time options and evening classes for some degrees are designed to fit the needs of working professionals. Details online by searching Penn LPS, a proud supporter of WHYY.
Morris Arboretum supports WHYY and invites visitors to experience summer as it used to be with its new exhibit, Take a Seat, Adirondack Chairs Reinterpreted. More than 35 artists have created 70 unique Adirondack chairs that will be on exhibit at Morris Arboretum and at Woodmere Art Museum now through Labor Day. Morris Arboretum celebrates summer and encourages visitors to take a seat and take in the summer landscape. More info at morrisarboretum.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, it'll be time for the question of the week. What kind of lavender should you grow? English, French, Spanish? Or do those names mean nothing? We'll tell you the secrets of lavender and how to grow your own when we get to the question of the week after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Matthew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Good. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing great. First of all, I'd just like to let you know I love your show. I wish you were on more often.
Why, thank you. I don't want to work that hard, however. Where are you? Where are you, Matt?
I'm in Pennsylvania right now, in Hammett, Pennsylvania, right outside of Erie, but I'm from Warren, Michigan.
You're from Warren, Michigan, and you're in Pennsylvania now?
Yeah. Okay. I'm a truck driver.
Oh, okay. So you're listening to us on the satellite?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very good. Yeah, we love being there on the NPR channel. All right. What can we do for Matt on the road? I presume this is a question about Michigan?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I have some problems with some hostas. They border along a deck and along a sidewalk area. And every year they come up, they're full, they have huge leaves on them, they're very healthy. But it looks like something's eaten on them. There'll be holes on the edge of the leaf and in the center of the leaf. And once the hole is there, it gets like a little brown area around it, like it's burnt. Yeah. But I never see any infestation, any critters on them, any bugs on them. So I'm kind of wondering what it is.
Yours is the easiest problem in the world to diagnose. When I hear about problems with hostas, it can only be three things. One, they're planted in the sun when they need shade, and they just burn up when that happens. Two is their toe.
Yep, they're definitely in the sun.
Pardon?
They're definitely in the sun. They're in full sun.
Oh, well, they're shade-loving plants, Matt. Don't you find them? Well, you're in Michigan, though, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so that you almost don't count. Your sun is like not like a sun down in Georgia or something like that.
Okay.
But if you're going to plant any more, they would prefer shade, and there's a lot of other plants that need full sun, and they might prefer that location. So you might want to think about swapping some plants around at the fall, because that's, you know, sunny areas, at least in my landscape, are few and far between, and I would put sun-loving plants there. When hostas are eaten completely to the ground, it's deer. When holes appear in the leaves and you never see anything doing the damage, it is guaranteed to be slugs. Slugs love hostas. They hide under those big leaves during the day, and they only come out and do their dirty work at night. Now, I can prove it's slugs to you. The next time you're home, crack open a beer at 6 o'clock in the evening. And you may have a couple of sips yourself, but make sure you pour some into little like margarine tubs, little containers, and put them around the leaves of your hostas. In the morning, I guarantee they'll be filled with dead, drunken slugs. And then what you want to do is you want to go to a garden center, you want to go online, and you want to look for one of the new generation slug baits. These are products with names like Sluggo and Escargo, and their active ingredient is iron phosphate. All it is a little iron phosphate wrapped in a yeasty bait. Slugs always go to yeast. That's why you can drown them in beer traps, but, you know, who wants to keep buying beer for your slugs? So you spread this slug bait around. They're attracted by the yeast. They can't metabolize the iron. All the slugs will die. And not only does this not harm anything else in your environment, the small amounts of iron and the natural activity of the living yeast are all good for your soil. So as this slug, quote, poison degrades, it actually feeds your soil and keeps your soil alive. And it gets rid of the slugs. So that's a very easy thing to take care of.
Oh, thank you very much. That's great.
All right, Matt?
Okay, thanks, buddy.
All right, you drive safe, sir.
Okay, bye-bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Brenda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, Mike, thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Brenda. Where are you?
I'm in Blanchester, Ohio.
And where is that?
That's southwest. In the bottom of Ohio, close to Cincinnati.
Very
about 30
good.
Miles.
Very good. What can we do for Brenda near Cincinnati?
I have 5 tomato plants, and one of them wilted. I've never had a tomato plant wilt before.
Huh. But the other 4 are unaffected by whatever this is?
Well, no. It turns out that there's one that's really bad, and then there's another one that's sort of droopy.
And are they all the same variety, or are they different?
No, they're all different.
What's the one that suffered the worst?
It's one. I bought 2 from Lowe's, and it's one of the 2. It's called Black Prince Tomato.
Oh, I like Black. That's a very good heirloom tomato.
Right. I thought it would be. So anyway, I thought maybe it needed more water because I read that I should be watering 1 inch a week. I'd been giving only 1/2 inch, so I did water it, all my tomato plants again. It looked better the next day, which was Saturday morning, I guess. It looked better, but then by Saturday afternoon, it was terrible.
Okay. Now, the tomatoes are in full sun?
Yes.
And they wilt during the height of the day?
Yes.
How do they look after the sun goes down that evening without you doing anything?
You know, I haven't looked right at the very beginning of the evening.
I think, are you having hot, sunny weather?
Not really hot. I mean, it's like 80 today. That's not bad for Ohio.
Do they get any shade during the day?
Before the sun goes down.
Okay.
Yes, and at about 6.
Okay, so that's full day sun. Are they growing in raised beds or flat ground?
Raised beds.
Excellent, excellent. What do you feed them?
I haven't been feeding. In fact, I talked to my local extension agent, and he thought I should be out there feeding them.
Well, do you add a little compost to the raised beds every season?
Oh, yes. This is just my second season with a raised bed. And, yes, I added at least 2 inches of compost.
That's all the feeding these plants need. Do you have a mulch on the surface of the soil?
Not really.
And when you water, how do you water?
Well, I know you're supposed to water, by letting it melt in and not sprinkle in. But I have been using a regular sprayer.
Right. And what time of day?
In the morning. So
okay. What I want you to do in the future, take the nozzle off your hose and just let the hose sit naked in the middle of your tomatoes and let the water run at a drip in the morning for a couple of hours once a week.
Okay, that would work.
Really soak the soil. Now, mm-hmm. Is there any discoloration on the tomato branches or leaves?
Not that particular plant, but a couple of the leaves are now just really fried dry.
Yeah, I think your tomatoes are just experiencing heat stress.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure why. There may be a reflective area behind them that's concentrating the heat. They may just be in a spot that is holding the heat. Do you have any kind of a cooling mulch you can use? Since do you have any shredded leaves from last season?
I do have. They're not. Well, they're kind of shredded. I do.
I would try to break them up a little bit so they don't turn into a tarp.
Right.
But I would cover the surface of the soil with the shredded leaves. This is going to retain the moisture. I'm afraid that your tomatoes, the good part is I think this could just be a, quote, cultural problem. I think they're just getting overheated during the day. One of the things I always tell people about tomatoes is I see this in mine. They don't like being in the hot sun all day. And during the summertime, it is not unusual for all my tomato plants to be seriously wilting at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh.
But I've been doing this for 35 years, and I've lost all ability to panic. So, after dinner, I'll go out with a glass of wine in my hand at like 8 mm-hmm. o'clock at night, and sure enough, everybody's all happy again.
Good.
And it's just like us if we're out in the desert. They're just, they're just broiling, right. And they're trying to protect themselves. So you make sure you really saturate that soil at least once a week. If your weather turns hot and dry, you can do that up to twice a week.
Right.
Put a mulch on the surface of the soil, just an inch or two, that'll help retain the soil moisture. This will also help keep the roots cooler, which is going to help the plant.
Right.
And don't react to anything you see in the middle of the day. Go out at 8 o'clock at night.
I'll get that wine, and I'll say the voodoo charm, and I'll go out at 8, and it all's going to be well.
And if not, certainly by the next morning, it will be. And I think this is just heat stress. Nothing's wrong disease-wise. You just take care of the plants a little bit differently. And mm-hmm. if anything goes wrong, you just call us back.
I will. And, oh, gosh, thank you.
My pleasure, Brenda. You take care now.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Lavender, a lovely lady with many names. Well, here's a lovely lady with one name. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer. Read off this week's questions, if you please.
Well, we heard from Josie near Cherry Hill, New Jersey, who writes, I'm interested in growing a few lavender plants. I want the variety with the wonderful fragrance that is harvested to make sachets. Can you please advise me? We also heard from Melanie in Kingsport, Tennessee, who writes, I love the lavender planted along my walk, but it's trying to cross the walk. The plants are about 5 years old, and the stems are quite woody. Can they be trimmed back or pruned? I don't want to harm them because I enjoy the flowers, the heavenly scent, and the year-round color of the plants. The variety is Provence, and I'm in Zone 6.
Although I am totally guilty of using the common country names of Spanish, English, and French to describe the different types of lavender, I should know better. And lavender fiend Ellen Spector Platt goes to great lengths to warn about people like me in her excellent book, Lavender, How to Grow and Use the Fragrant Herb. The designations French, Spanish, and English are not botanical reference points, she warns, urging gardeners to select the perfect variety for their climate and intended use by the botanical name. It may take a bit more time, especially if your favorite catalog or grower just lists a country name, but it's the only way to get the exact type you need and want. That means it's time for a little botany lesson. The genus name for all lavenders is Lavandula. The most common species is Angustifloria, which means narrow-leaved. Its country name is English, at least when the namer gets it right, and it's also known as true lavender. Ellen explains that all of the varieties in this species have the sweet fragrance that many growers seek, and the plants are quick to bloom, often producing flowers their second year even when started from seed. These are also the most cold-hardy varieties, surviving winter nicely in Zone 6 and often in Zone 5. Ellen describes 20 different name varieties of this species in her book, and they showcase a dazzlingly diverse array of attributes. Heights from 7 inches to 3 feet, with flower colors in white, pink, blue, and gray, as well as the familiar light purplish-violet hue. Different varieties have different bloom times, and some can even bloom more than once a season if the first run of flowers is promptly removed. So-called Spanish lavender is generally the Stoicus species, but a plant labeled French lavender could be either Stoicus or Dentana. Either way, these are true Mediterranean plants that are going to do best in areas warmer than Zone 6. And there are many other species. Latifloria, or spike lavender, is tall with broad leaves and bright blue flowers, but Ellen warns that the blooms smell like camphor instead of lavender. Just as winter hardy as the English types, a cross known as Intermedia is recommended for areas with high humidity and for the best dried flowers, but it can't be grown from seed. You have to start with cuttings. Ellen describes 10 different varieties of this species, highly praising the fragrance of several, including the well-known Provence. And yes, this means that despite its variety name, Provence is not a, quote, French lavender. Many types of lavender can be grown from seed, but the plants cross-pollinate so readily it's hard for growers to be sure that the seeds in any given packet are going to produce the exact plants you want. This is not the seed producer's fault. These plants are just really frisky in the field. Nursery starts are more reliable for getting an exact variety, and cuttings taken from a fellow gardener's lavender will always produce the exact same plant. The biggest requirements for any lavender are full sun and excellent drainage. Not good drainage, excellent drainage. Planting in heavy clay, compacted soil, or areas that drain poorly will kill the plants. So if you don't have naturally loose soil, lighten up the area with lots of perlite, soil-free mix, or sand before planting. Lavender also prefers its soil on the alkaline side. So if your earth is acidic, use lime or wood ash to get the pH up between 7 and 8. Don't worry about feeding. A little compost once a year is all these plants need. Now, to avoid the overgrown woody look that many lavenders develop, give the plants a nice light pruning every spring, about 2 weeks after all threat of frost is gone, which is right around the same time you should be pruning your roses. This will keep the plants tidy and productive, and alive. Ellen warns that old plants that are heavily pruned after years of neglect often join the choir invisible. One option in such circumstances is to tear up the old lavender and replant a fresh batch. Many growers do this every 5 years or so anyway to keep the plants vigorous, and it allows you to choose a variety that might be better suited to your space. Otherwise, Ellen suggests pruning 1/3 of an overgrown plant back heavily each spring over a 3-year stretch to get it back into shape without killing it. always an admirable horticultural goal. Well, that sure was a lot of things to think about when you think about lavender now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, with all those Latin names spelled out much better than I can pronunciate them, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to plant me in poorly drained soil if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, just like yours, we're telling you, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. A very special tip of the garden hat this week to old friend and noted garden author Ellen Spector Platt, whose great book, Lavender, How to Grow and Use the Fragrant Herb, provided most of the details for the question of the week. Sweetly scented Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Brightly blooming Kelly Haggerty is our production assistant. Our esteemed editor is the properly pruned Al Banks. I look like lavender but smell like camphor, Mike McGrath. And I'll see you next week. Squash vine borers and flea beetles can take quite a bite out of your produce production. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the clever tricks two listeners devised to stop these pests, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike whimsically walks us through the ways of woodbine, wheat, winter squash, weeds, and warm weather, the wiles of a wonderful garden, every Saturday morning at 11 here on WHYY.
Violent crime in the U.S. is the lowest it's been in decades, but that doesn't mean you should let your guard down.
Burglars like to target homes they think are not occupied. So people that leave their mail out or their newspapers,